Friends, let me say first of all that I am very pleased to be in Dunedin and speak to the audience which is present here. The subject on which I am to speak is a world in transition. For long, human life on earth has presented the picture of various isolated kingdoms and areas with little contact with one another. The people in each area living their lives largely in a settled traditional manner. They had little knowledge of this earth, let alone all that science has brought to light in the recent centuries. They lived a comparatively simple life under various physical limitations. There were, even in those old days, great centers of learning, of art, philosophy, and craftsmanship. Culture, in a very real sense, at least in some countries. We must not assume that it is only we who are cultured, but not these ancient people who did not have jet planes, electronic machines, and things of that sort. In those days, everything changed very slowly, except occasionally when there was a revolution or some other sensational event. History seemed, on the whole, to move slowly. Humanity did progress, I think, but it was progress of a sort which did not involve much outward movement, either physically or in the knowledge of the world of matter. But when the hour struck, if I may put it so, all this began to change. Progress since then, along the lines of science and technology, has been faster and faster. Until now, you find that the changes are taking place so swiftly that many people feel as if they are living in the midst of a turbulent torrent, rocked from one side to the other. Along with the changes in science and technology, there have been changes also in the field of human living, because we have now available to us apparatus of different sorts, which makes life more comfortable than ever before, which provides us with various facilities for intercommunication which did not exist, and facilities of other sorts. Now, all this began to change some time ago, but the change has been accelerating all the time. So we now come to this century, which is a century of crisis and violence, which has witnessed a complete uprooting of the past, although the future has yet to take a definite shape. This has been, perhaps, the most extraordinary century of all in human history. Even if we think of the 19th century, the last one, conditions then were comparatively stable. There was, of course, colonialism, as it is called, people going out, colonizing other countries and ruling the peoples there, imperialism and things of that sort. But all those ideas which really belong to human relationships have passed away, and at present what is predominant, causing a great deal of trouble, especially in the newly self-governing states, is the sentiment of nationalism. Either this nationalism will have to be transmuted into something different, or it will have to pass away as the feeling of human unity comes to prevail. The whole world is physically a unity, in the sense that all its parts are interconnected. But then it has to become politically and economically one, but it is far from doing so at present. That is the situation in which we stand. The old physical and geographical barriers have been overcome, so that all the peoples of the world who have their own different cultures, they are all together for better or for worse. And as I have just said, it is a world of communications in which there is the constant movement of people, of goods and of ideas. And these communications are becoming swifter and swifter. So instead of a peaceful world where everyone stayed put, we are now in a world of constant movement, all the time people flashing to and fro, also news and ideas similarly in movement. And what really characterizes this particular century is this extraordinary speed of living, the multiplicity of contacts which these movements have brought about, and also the fact that man has mastered various of the secrets of nature and has been able to lay his hands upon certain forces which he is using for different purposes. He is using them for establishing communications, for producing all kinds of goods which did not exist before, and also for inventing and creating weapons which can destroy better than any weapon could at any previous time. And all these features of this 20th century, which have become so accentuated during the last decade or two, constitute for humanity as a whole a terrific problem. Now, how is this problem going to be solved? Obviously, the solution lies in some form of overall control, by means of which the different peoples, the different organized states can be brought into a harmonious relationship with one another, and there can be a fruitful and constructive interaction between them along various lines, cultural, political, economic, and so on. Now, what has taken place is nothing short of an extraordinary revolution, the nature of which no one could have anticipated in the last century, let alone the previous centuries. And this revolution has not only changed the whole picture of human life, but it has taken place also in the picture of the world, the picture of the universe, as seen through the eyes of science. It is really through the growth of science, which has been a process of centuries, but has latterly become extremely rapid, that all these changes have come about. And the scientific picture of today is very different from what it was early in this century. There are many people who are living today who can compare the ideas of advanced science today with the ideas which prevailed at the beginning of this century and with which we became acquainted during our school days. So there has a revolution in the world of knowledge of the material world, and also in human relationships, the world of human living. Now, if I may mention just one or two points with regard to the extraordinary changes which have come about in the scientific thought, there is no longer the idea of a solid, stable, material, mechanical picture which characterized the scientific thought of last century. Madame H. P. Blavatsky, who was one of the founders of the Theosophical movement, challenged that picture in unmistakable terms. But it is really the scientists of this century, like Einstein, Rutherford and others, who broke up that picture, who unscrambled, so to say, the world egg, as it has been called in Indian mythology. What appears to be solid is not really solid at all according to the modern science, but is either a series of waves or clusters of particles according to exigencies. And in modern science, there is this strange idea of energy without any particular medium. For a long time, it was supposed that all these wave motions took place in a universal medium which was then called ether. But since then, science has found it unnecessary to postulate such a background, and therefore it is now possible for us to send various waves of different lengths in space, as it is called. Space, of course, being that which remains when all things which are in it have been taken away. So we see that science is really becoming more and more abstract and metaphysical, and therefore it is becoming more removed than ever before from the reality in terms of human experience or any other reality that one might think of. Yet, although science is so abstract in its fundamental concepts, such as the space-time continuum, which of course is one of Einstein's ideas, yet these concepts fit in with the concrete world. And by means of these concepts, the scientist is able to do what he wants. For instance, he has been able to break up the invisible atom, which shows, of course, the unity between metaphysics and physics. The atom itself is not perceptible to human sight. Nobody can see it even with the utmost magnification. And the whole construction of the atom, which you find in scientific articles and books, is merely an imagination of what it could be. Yet this imaginative atom has been broken with extremely concrete and devastating results. But after having said all this, I should point out that the advanced scientists of today are the very first to admit that the knowledge which science has been gathering is far from having fallen into a final or completed pattern. Science was much more dogmatic and finalistic in its theories and attitude in the last century than it is at present. And it would not be a great surprise if there has to be a fundamental revision of the scientific hypotheses and theories which now hold the field. And of course, from the theosophical point of view, the pattern will never be complete until certain factors which are beyond the scientific ken are introduced into the whole picture. So we see that both the scientific revolution and the revolution in the world of human relations are still continuing. They have not come to an end by any means. Anyone who has been reading the newspapers of the last few weeks or months can well realize that we have not yet found stability in the field of human relationships. Nor is there a relationship with nature which can be said to be very satisfactory and helpful to both, because man does so many things by he is making all kinds of indentation, so to say, in the body of nature, and it remains to be seen how nature will recoil upon him. But all these changes which have been taking place are due to just one factor which arose in a very, very small key and has been gradually magnifying itself in a kind of crescendo until at present it seems to be booming with a large number of trumpets. I mean the analytical mind of man, that mind which with which one differentiates things, by which he probes into nature of various things and substances, by which also he objectifies what would otherwise be something not known to man. And now this analysis, in which the scientists and the mathematicians excel, is also being carried into the field of the human consciousness, although it is only the crust of that human consciousness which has been broken so far. What is called psychoanalysis merely rakes up the elements which are, so to say, in the surface nature of man, even though they may be considered elements which are in the subconscious, because the subconscious is perhaps what you might call the basement of the human consciousness, and it is not any of the upper stories. And by means of this analytical mind, which is constantly splitting things, just as it has split the atom, man is producing what might be called new knowledge. Everything is broken up further and further. Even the nucleus of the atom is being broken into so many particles, and no scientist is certain how many particles there are and what they are doing there. So in this way, by breaking down, by probing inside things, by exposing that world which has hitherto been hidden, science has been expanding the field of knowledge. But then we must remember that it is not enough merely to break down things and produce new categories of substances. Life is not merely a process of breaking down. Although every living form is subject to decline, it disintegrates, it breaks down, and the form ceases to exist. But life is essentially a process of building up. Wherever you see life at work, whether in a cell or a tree or in the human body, you find always there is a certain process of integration. Diverse substances are brought together and organized in such a way that the different parts, the different organs, work in coordination. So you also see that when a man is listening, for instance, to a beautiful musical symphony, the effect which is produced upon his consciousness or upon his nature is an integrative effect. He doesn't feel disintegrated after listening to such a symphony, but somehow he feels that he is more of a whole than he had been previously. To see life whole, it has been said, is to see life clear. But when I see life whole can perhaps best be understood in this way: to see the life in the form, because life is always a whole, it is always an integer, it coordinates the different functions, it constitutes that center of consciousness where all the impressions which are received are brought into a single expressive picture. Now we are, I think, this is my understanding of the whole situation, we are in the process of building up a new human world picture through a series of trials and errors. And all the talk that is going on about East and West and balancing the forces and the mutual deterrent and all that is, I would consider it as one of those trials and errors by means of which we will come through to that happy coordination which must be the eventual result. And we are also in the process of building up a new picture of the universe which would be scientific and at the same time much more beautiful and appealing perhaps than the picture we have today, which of course is a flickering picture, like one of those pictures which used to be projected by the cinematograph at the beginning of this century. The old picture of the human world had to be pulled down because it was not satisfying. Its elements were all in wrong relationships. I referred to the fact that the last century was a period of colonial expansion, a period during which one people, more vigorous, more knowledgeable and endowed with more resources, were able to conquer and rule other people. Now that relationship of ruled and rulers is no longer considered to be a valid formula. There was also slavery in the last century. In America there was a tremendous struggle, a terrific civil war for the sake of abolishing that system. Now, in that system, there is a relationship between man and man which is not a satisfactory relationship. Because there were so many relationships which did not agree with certain fundamental principles that commend themselves to the human mind, therefore the relations had all to be altered. Continually there is in the human consciousness an emergence of new ideas, new doctrines. For instance, there is the idea of individual liberty. Of course that idea existed also in the old days, but perhaps it is much more pronounced at present than it has been at any previous time. And then there is the idea of democracy in the political field, which is also an expression of individual freedom and the equality of one person with other persons. And there is further this idea of human brotherhood, in which we recognize the fact that the high and the low, people of all sorts, the clever and the stupid, they all constitute a brotherhood. They are all in a state of mutual dependence upon one another. That all the external distinctions really pale into insignificance in the light of that fundamental fact that we all share the same life, we have essentially the same nature, and we are destined to reach the same goal. And now in the field of science, there have been, of course, the various upsetting discoveries which correspond to the new notions which have made their appearance in the human mind. Now in this process of building up a new pattern, which would be a complete pattern, there is the concept of totalitarianism, which I think is one of the extremes on either side of that mean or middle path in which alone there is equilibrium and peace. Totalitarianism appeals to many people not only because they find it a convenient thing for their purposes, but also because there is a certain truth. It is founded upon a certain truth which is narrowly and falsely interpreted. The essential truth which underlies the totalitarian idea is the unity of man, the falseness of the division between society and individual. We have to consider them absolutely together. And also the impossibility of dividing human life into compartments and solving their problems separately. Because man is a whole, what happens to him in one compartment of his life alters his mind when it operates in other compartments or divisions. So we have to take life as a totality. But this totality should not mean the negation or the abrogation of individual freedom, but in some way it has to comprehend within itself the freedom of the various individual units. So we really need a world synthesis, a union of all, which is based upon certain fundamental principles that are absolutely valid, but with liberty to each And it is this individual liberty to develop one's own genius and one's own culture, which I think is at the root of nationalism. What we call nationalism might be a kind of magnified individualism. It may be the expression of a will to assert oneself and gain various advantages over others, or it might be an expression of one's own innate genius, the particular service and contribution which one can make to the life of the whole community. Now, in the field of knowledge, I think that the kind of synthesis which should result would be not merely a stable scientific picture, but it should be a synthesis of science, philosophy, and religion. And what is called theosophy, which is not some kind of a far-fetched doctrine, but it is really that wisdom which exists in nature and which is open to discovery and study, stands for such a synthesis. A synthesis which will be capable of being studied in a scientific and logical manner, but which will hold within it a certain content which might truly be called philosophical or religious. Theosophy gives a certain outline of the whole cosmos and of the constitution of man in which such a synthesis is possible. Because what is called science deals with the purely external aspect, but this external body or organization has a certain relationship to the consciousness of man, and that consciousness in its turn is related to something else which is at present an unknown, the nature of which can be realized only in that consciousness itself. Even when science was beginning to break down the old scientific picture, there were the ingredients in the theosophical wisdom by means of which a new picture could be made out. A change has taken place, as we can all see, in the ideas of people all over the world with regard to matters of religion, because of the increasing freedom of thought which has characterized the advancement of modern science. So nowadays, to speak of spiritual things in a scientific frame is no longer paradoxical. The frame may be a scientific frame, but what is inside the frame, the content of it, may be something that has the character of life, the character of what I would call spiritual. And how theosophy helps to bring about this synthesis is by showing the relationship between consciousness and spirit, that unknown element on the one side and matter on the other. In this way, it can lead men's minds to a true conception of spirituality. There is matter and there is life, and from life there arises this extraordinary thing which we call consciousness. And in that consciousness there is the possibility of various realizations or truths which are to be attributed to that unknown element or factor, or whatever you call it, this spirit. Spirituality does not lie in practicing any kind of a creed or outer system, nor is it merely running away from the world and secluding oneself. No one can really find that contentment and happiness which everyone seeks by secluding himself from his fellow human beings in a state of defeatism or disillusionment. Spirituality is really conforming one's whole thought and one's whole behavior to that which is inmost and truest in oneself, so that you are most even one's yourself when you are spiritual. Whereas we are all, to a greater or less extent, artificial in various ways. We have been molded by the world according to the prevailing thought, and we are constantly adapting ourselves to the ideas of other people. So in that way, we are not as much ourselves as perhaps we imagine ourselves to be. Now, the world synthesis cannot really be produced without unity in the hearts of people. You might have any kind of an organization however excellent it may be for its purpose, but unless there is a feeling of unity in the hearts of human beings everywhere, then the organization is likely gradually to suffer a process of entropy, as they say in scientific terms. That is to say, it's likely to gradually decline and collapse. So we need a realization of that human unity which exists under the various differences of nationality, of race, of temperament, of outlook which people present. Man needs, I think, to discover himself behind the various masks which have been put upon him or which he has put upon himself. That is to say, everything that he thinks and everything that is belongs to the outer nature is merely a mask which eclipses and sometimes suppresses the nature of that life which is within his form. So it is only a discovery of what he is inside himself as a soul, apart from the religion he may profess, apart from the nationality to which he may belong, from the various political ideas which he might have imbibed, and all the ideas that might have been bred in him by his economic condition and by his associations and so on. It is only a knowledge of that true being of man which will enable him to realize and not merely talk of his brotherhood with all other human beings. And when he discovers this fundamental nature of himself, which underlies every form of superimposition that might have taken place in the course of his relationship with people, then he will be able to realize various truths, which will be truths that form the new age that may be opening before us. The age of science is really an age of interaction between mind and matter, because the scientist has a mind with which he observes, he probes into the nature of matter. But on the other hand, material conditions mold the human consciousness and the human mind. Man is all the time reacting to external conditions, and by these reactions, his own nature is molded in a certain fashion. So we see that there is this interaction between mind and matter all the time. Most people do not realize this fact. They think that they are acting upon the external world. But even as they act upon the external world, the world acts upon them. So they become modified, they become changed, they are shaped in various ways by the very actions, by the very thought in which they indulge. But this kind of a relationship between mind and matter completely leaves out that spiritual or divine nature which is latent in each individual. Because the mind is exclusively turned towards the field of matter, therefore it has moved away from that inner reality which is in the heart of man, which, as I said, is related to his own consciousness in a potential way, but has not yet been realized there. So it is a material mind which at present sways the lives and destinies of people. You look at all the people in the world, look at their aims, their objectives, their interests, the various things which they are chasing and pursuing, which they are trying to acquire and possess. Surely you would call that a material mind, even though the person may put in an appearance on Sundays at some church or temple or some place of religious worship. You will find that it is a material mind which is also determining our destinies in the United Nations and various other conferences which take place. Because the outlook is not the outlook of human unity. It is all the time one set of interests against another, contending for a position of vantage from which to speak or to dictate to the other side. So I think it is not untrue to say that it is really the materialistic mind which is at present active and of which we see evidence on all sides. And even those people who call themselves religious are essentially materialistic because they are self-centered. because they are separative in their own outlook upon other people, and they are concerned with saving what they call their own souls, which are merely a projection from their own ignorance, projection from their particular background. So what I feel is necessary is that there has to be a change in the mentality of people, so that this other factor, namely the spiritual nature of man, which is completely left out on one side, is brought into the process of his life, so that it has also its say. It also figures in his thought and in his doings. I think people have to realize that all material conditions really exist for a certain soul culture. Why do we have all these possibilities of communication with so many people? Comfortable homes and this and that, there are so many things. But merely material things will never bring about contentment or happiness. I was only reading the other day an article in one of the New Zealand papers which pointed out that amongst all the countries in Europe, the country where there is material abundance and comfort, where there is most comfort, is Sweden. And at the same time, it is in Sweden that the suicide rate is highest amongst all the countries in Europe, because people get so tired of life, they find that life, even in the most comfortable conditions, a monotony and a boredom. And in spite of all the distractions which are to be found in modern life, they only produce a state of increasing discontent and emptiness of heart and mind. So I think that we have to realize the fact that there is something else needed to produce real contentment and happiness. Man cannot live by bread alone, nor can he live merely by the radio and cinema or anything else that you might associate particularly with the modern life. All material conditions are meant to be like a vase, a beautiful vase, in for the flower of the soul. But then it has to flower. We have to realize that what we regard as the values of life may not be the true values. The true values are the values of the soul, the deeper being of man, and not the values of the mind, because the mind is swayed by so many different forces. At present, the mind of man, I am talking in general terms, there will be numerous exceptions, the mind of man is alienated from his own deeper being. You know, the modern psychologist talks of the fact that a person may be alienated from himself. That is to say, there may be one part of his nature, which is the real part, his own true being, but then his mind may be separated from it, and it might indulge in all kinds of illusions, in all kinds of notions which are completely false, which are absolutely unsatisfying to the individual himself. And I think that there is somewhat of an alienation between the mind of the modern man, which is so much under the stress of material influences, and his own deeper, quieter, reposeful being, which of course does not come into the picture at the present. Therefore, we find that there is so much discontent all over the world. There is a certain unhappiness everywhere. There is a feeling of emptiness and loneliness in the hearts and minds, even of those people who live in a state of luxury, who have all the pleasures that they want. The emptiness in the heart is due to the lack of a certain truth, that truth which belongs to his own innermost nature. And this emptiness cannot be filled by anything which may be invented by the mind. You can invent all kinds of things to produce excitement, sensation, pleasure, distraction, anything that you like. But all that will not fill this emptiness, which is due to the fact that it can be filled only by a certain truth which comes into being only when the mind comes to a state of quietness and repose, when it is not running off in various tangential directions, chasing all kinds of shadows. I think that one has to realize that the mind is but an instrument of the soul, that is to say, the deeper being. And it is only when that deeper being expresses itself to some extent that the mind is able to fulfill the purpose for which it exists. A person may be a genius. He might have great creative talent. But then he is able to create something which comes, as it were, from the depths of his nature. If you think of the way in which a great symphony, let us say, is born, you will find that there is always a certain feeling which seems, or an idea which arises, as it were, from nowhere, from the depths of the person himself. And whether it is the genius of a particular people or the soul of an individual, it will begin to flower, I think, only when there is a certain integration of this outgoing mind with that soul nature which is at rest, but which is very much at the back of this mind. Or to put it in simple words, one might say, until there is a union of the heart and the mind, that is a simple way of saying the same thing, it will not be possible for a man to flower with that genius or with that soul nature which is in himself. The mind of the modern man has to know itself and its own limitations. We assume, because we are clever in a certain way, that by this mind we can achieve all things. But the mind is capable of achieving certain things and certainly not other things. So when this mind, which is so active at the present time, so dominant, and has such a wide field over which to range, realizes its own limitations, then it will begin to turn in a new direction. So I feel that the present age is certainly not a time in which there can be found stability or peace or even the highest possible culture which man can produce. It must be succeeded by another age or epoch or period, call it what you like, in which there is a greater appreciation of those things which are of value from the standpoint of the wholeness of the individual being, not only that part which is the mind, but the wholeness of his nature, to which I spoke of as the soul of man. There has to be an appreciation of the way in which life should be lived in order to make it rich and creative in a true sense. And this creation will be not only with the surface mind which comes into play, but with something deeper than that mind. I think these are realizations which can become widespread amongst all people of humanity. So we have to move on from this age of the mind. Of course, the mind is able to do many things. It is able to study and observe and find out the truth about the world of matter by which it is surrounded. But we have to proceed from that mind to a different kind of mind, which will at the same time be scientific, logical, precise, and also capable of creating forms in which can be embodied the truth which it perceives inside itself. I do not know how to put it in simpler terms. That is to say, man will be able to create things of great value, create things which have an enduring significance. He will be able to create those masterpieces which we find in every field of art, for instance. But he will have the genius to create only when he is able to get deep within himself and contact that real nature in which there is creativity. And that deeper nature is what we call soul and spirit. Now, of course, there is a certain distinction to be drawn between these different terms, but I will not go into that. If we think of a nature which is purely spiritual, to which the intellect is allied, of which the intellect can become an instrument, it is that nature which at the present time is quiescent, which is suppressed, but which should come into play increasingly in the times to come. And then when there is that nature in action, then we will find that the whole world will become a much more beautiful world. Then there will be true peace on earth, because there will be a realization of the brotherhood of all human beings. And we will be able also to contact that reality within oneself, in which there is the possibility of contentment, of happiness, of creating beautiful things, by which things which will be a joy forever. I think that humanity is in a process of transition to that happier age, a more spiritual climate, a different outlook upon the world, which will be an outlook of peace and human brotherhood. Since we have to move on to such a period in order to find stability where we can rest, where there will not be a violent change all the time, I have called the present time a time of transition. Even to speak of transition is to take an optimistic view, because if this is not a transition to something better than this, then surely we are coming near to the end of all things. Either the world is going to destroy itself, or it is going to find a stable basis on which it can progress securely in the different fields which are open to human beings. So to talk of a world in transition is to take the hopeful view that the evolution of man has not yet come to an end, that there is very much more for him to do. He is capable of achieving better things than he has achieved so far, and he can live a life which is rich, which is creative, and which is satisfying in every sense.